I think there are a couple of things we can do. Sharon doesn't like this book.
Really?
No. I do like it.
You like it?
I do. It's really
I relate to this.
This book, Jordan, was written by Archimandrite Simeon Craigiopoulos. An Archimandrite is someone who has responsibility for a monastery, so he's the head of a monastery. Archimandrite Simeon died about 6 years ago, I guess. Felt very elderly, not very active the last few years of his life, but earlier was very well known in Greece and east of Greece as a spiritual guide. He founded two monasteries, a monastery for men and a monastery of women. Both of them were outside of, not far away from Thessaloniki, on the northeastern coast of Greece. And he was known especially for his interest in using the ideas of psychology to make traditional Orthodox spiritual teachings more accessible to contemporary people. And that was the origin of this book. So what page are we on? I'll check with Steve. He always
would you like to share?
I thought we were going through 49 through 64, I think.
Okay, 49.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're up to 49.
Yeah, through 64 is where we're going to start.
Okay, submission which doesn't liberate. Now, for the sake of Jordan and for the sake of my kind of my own recommitment to this book, I'm going to say some things in general about it, not by looking page by page or section by section, but I'll make this point. We are probably all familiar with an encouragement by spiritual writers in the Orthodox Christian tradition and in St. Paul's letters and in the Gospels, the Gospel writers as well, the encouragement not to be attached to the things of the world, not to be unduly, that is beyond what is necessary, attached to the things of the world. St. John Chrysostom is a 4th century bishop. He was the bishop of the church in Constantinople in the 4th century, had a lot of conflicts with the emperor, with the government, the empress in particular. He kind of told things the way they were, and they didn't like that. He was much beloved of the people. But in the end, he was sent into exile by the emperor and died in exile in a remote district. But St. John Chrysostom, when it comes to attachment to the things of the world, said that anything that we own beyond what we need belongs to someone else. He's the most radical. But radical means to the root, and that gets to the root of things, the idea of amassing wealth and building ourselves up in our own eyes by the ownership of things and denying things to others, even when it means life and death to them. This is not something that Chrysostom, or this is the kind of the official understanding of the church, but this is not something that is imposed, you know. And in general, that's the case with Orthodoxy. It's very seldom that you see anything, even once it's clearly defined, you'd never see an effort to somehow impose it on people. Because the understanding is that spiritual life is for all of us to start where we are and repent of our attachment to the world greater than God. Repent, meaning to turn around, and then to move. Each one of us has to move ourselves toward Christ, toward God, away from love of the world, attachment to the world. The idea that we have of the fall had to do with turning away from God and becoming attached to the world by eating the fruit of the tree that was forbidden. Eve's hope, and then she gave, you know, the fruit to her husband and tempted him as well. But the idea was that they had been lied to and told that eating this fruit of this tree would make them like God. Well, there is nothing that we can take from the created world that will make us like God. I mean, in fact, they were in communion with God, and they turned away from him in order to do that. And it's that turning away from God, according to our understanding, that brought death into the world. It wasn't so much God's forbidding it and their breaking his law and his punishing them. Our understanding is that it has to do with the reality of things, that God created us in such a way that we cannot live without communion with him. There is no life in us. There is no life in the world. The life that we have and the life that the created world has comes from God. He didn't create the world so that it's separate from him. Especially didn't create, and what's the link between the world that he created and God? It's us human beings. We are the link between the created world and God. And when Adam and Eve turned away from God and toward the world, death came into the world, all creation groaned. It was a consequence. We were meant to take things of the world and offer them up to God, not to use them as possessions, to try to build ourselves a sense of our wholeness without God. And this book is about that, although it's not always clear that it's about that, I think. But I think the part that's missing in our understanding when we think about what's being dealt with here is that, as I say, we're familiar with our understanding that we are not meant to be attached to the things of the world to try to gain a sense of completeness and wholeness without God, because we are not whole. We are not complete. You know, but it's not because the things of the world are not going to make us whole or complete, even if we come up with an image of ourselves based on our ownership of things that will make us feel whole. The approach of this book and the teaching of the spiritual fathers of the tradition stands behind it, is that it's not just the physical things of the world that we can become attached to. We can become attached to other persons as though they were less than persons and treat them as though they were things, that we can attach ourselves to someone that we consider to be especially gifted or powerful or strong or beautiful. And that attachment is one of the three strategies, Elder Simeon is saying, that causes us to leave the place of silence and communion with God that has been given back to us by Christ. Christ came into the world in order to make it possible for us to again, as human beings, have communion with God, the communion with God that was lost in the beginning. Orthodox, unlike Western churches, don't teach that with the fall, we lost the capacity to do good. But we do teach that the reality of communion with God is no longer available to us. We can learn a lot about God from the world that he created. The Orthodox also have a sense that in the world God created, he is not completely absent. His energies are present in the world. So we can have a certain kind of knowledge of God from the world, so long as we don't use the world as our possessions, objects of possession. But we don't have that direct communion with God. That was lost. Death came into the world, it becomes the barrier. Christ comes into the world, becomes incarnate of a woman, sharing our flesh, and he destroys the power of death over us and reestablishes the oneness of communion with God through our humanity, so that our salvation, not so much looked at as a legal arrangement, as oftentimes is in the West with Augustine and then also the reformers who followed Augustine in this idea. But our understanding is of salvation is that it is something that is returned to us as a path where we really can be one with God the Father through Christ. He says that he came here in order that we could be one with the Father as he is one. That communion is reestablished. And he says somewhere else, I'm trying to make links here that are not obvious from this text, and hopefully, and this will serve the purpose of giving you a little bit of introduction to what we're doing, and the others of us who are here in the past, to give a kind of more of a strong link between this, what's being dealt with here, and our previous understanding of our faith. There are three strategies, Elder Simeon says, and he uses the language of a particular psychologist. We won't go into that. One that is not incompatible with the Orthodox Christian spiritual tradition. Most psychologists are, you know, but yeah, this one is not. Sure. This one's not so much. Freud's not, Jung's not, Adler's not. All the biggies, uh-huh. You know. But this one is. Is there another example of this as well in another book that's more demanding than this one? But usually they're not. At any rate, there are three strategies that people use in order to try to gain a sense of wholeness by way of other people. One is by attaching themselves, as I said, to others. Someone is seen as being greater, more powerful, and you just kind of glom onto that person. And your identity is tied up with being glommed onto that person. And other people who are also, this ends up, I think, being a pretty effective term, this business of glomming onto somebody. You get glommed onto a whole movement.
So that'd be like celebrities or something.
Celebrities are a perfect example, yes. And then you have all of the other people who are followers of that celebrity. So now you have something in common. You have an identity. You have a sense of fulfillment. You have a sense of wholeness. And if that's dashed, your identity is dashed. And the second kind of strategy is a strategy of domination. We try to dominate other human beings as though they were not fully persons, as though they were objects, to be dominated, controlled, and what builds us up, the strong sense of ourselves. And we have a sense of wholeness that's based, again, on the misuse and abuse of other human beings, persons, not as persons, but as though they were like objects. And then the third kind of strategy is more difficult to describe. The third kind of strategy is a strategy of withdrawing away from others largely out of fear of being dominated, or withdrawing into ourselves in order to seek a sense of wholeness defined in a way by this kind of move. I would say, and I was thinking about this earlier tonight, I refuse to be dominated by them. I will stand, this is a curious way of thinking, I will stand on my own within myself. I will not submit to them. And so there is a withdrawal from others. Fear is certainly involved. But it's also, even though it's going on inside of us, a way of defining ourselves and feeling whole by way of a wrong relationship to other human beings, persons, as though they were fearful objects or animals that were not human, like me. They're different. They're enemies. So these are three strategies that Elder Simeon says that we use. Now, it's not a type. It's not as though, well, each one of us is one of these three types. I'm this way, you're that way, somebody else is a third way. That's not it. The idea is that we use all three of these strategies. There's probably going to be one that has been most successful for us. And so that's the one we depend on and rely on most. But the other two are also present there. You know, and we can switch from one to the other depending on whatever works best for us. And then finally, in the end, Elder Simeon says, there is, with our effort to accomplish a sense of wholeness, separate from God. God's not involved with this. Other people aren't actually involved with it, not as the persons they really are, because we're not treating them as persons. And we want this sense of wholeness. So we have these strategies, and in the end, we also have an idealized image of ourselves that is made up of all of these movements, and we confuse who we are with that idealized image. So the title, Do You Know Yourself? Do you know that you're involved in doing these things, these three strategies? Do you know that you have an idealized image and that you have confused yourself, the person that God has created, with this self-created idealized image? If you don't know that, then you don't know yourself. And that idealized image has got to be dealt with. Now, there are extreme versions, extreme ways of dealing with this understanding, one of which might be, from now on, I am going to deny all of these things. I'm just going to, it's bad that I am this way. I'm going to stop being this way. That would not work with respect to physical things that we need. It's undue attachment to the things of the world. We need food, we need clothing, we need shelter. We need things of the world. But we have no need to create ourselves within our own, you know, like make a nice, this is my tendency. I'll share it with you. It's kind of obvious if you know me. Wherever I'm at, I take whatever I've got at hand, organize it, arrange it, add to it in ways that fit with it, make myself a little womb room or a man cave, whatever you want to call it. And then I'm comfortable. This is my little world. I've created it out of the objects. And they don't have to be great things. But they're things that establish a kind of comfortable space for me. You know, and, you know, does God have to be involved? No. I can do it on my own. And I have a sense of comfort there. I have my comfort zone. And I have an image of myself that has to do with all of these things that I've collected. There is very closely related to this, my very favorite advertisement that I ran into. I've added it as a signature on my emails. You probably run into it because Sharon and I bought a cuckoo clock from China. It's not a German cuckoo clock. It's not even a knockoff. It's just kind of a Chinese-style cuckoo clock. It's made out of wood. It's very large. If it were German, it would cost like probably $2,500. But it was only a few hundred dollars. It's nice. But the interest, you know, if you read a manual written by Oriental people, an instruction manual, you're going to run into some strange wording. You know, and if you go to the website where they sell this cuckoo clock, there is an advertisement there that it is unintentionally honest. They haven't quite picked up how to write an ad for Americans. And the ad reads, if I can remember it, decorating your home can give you, with beautiful things, can give you a false sense of importance. Decorating your home gives the illusion that your life is more interesting than it really is. That's the ad. It's too true. It's too obvious. You need to fuzz it up a little bit. Yeah, that's the message. You're right. You know, that's what you're selling. You're selling this idea that you're going to build this little private space and people come in and say, ooh. You know, isn't this great? Yes, yes, that's what you're trying to do. That's how you sell things to people so that they can build a sense of who they are by going to, not Walmart, but some really wonderful store where great things can be bought. And there's people can be, ooh, you know. And it's this idea that you're trying to build this, I am expressing myself. Well, are you expressing yourself? What, you mean because you went out and bought all this stuff and coordinated it in some way? That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Well, but it is possible to have that be the way you are related to other human beings too. These three moves. So do you really love a person? If you get romantically, you fall in love with someone, there's a problem. But especially when we first start out and we don't know what love is really. And so we're kind of feeling our way along. And we have desires and biological attraction, and we can all too easily fall into a relationship where we are dealing with another person, and it's love, but it's self, starts with self-love, and it's attachment, glomming onto them, domination problems, and withdrawal, refusing to be dominated. Maybe we want to write up a marriage contract so that we're not sure, you know, for sure. We don't have to worry about being dominated because it's right there in the marriage contract. These certain things, these cannot happen. You know, no Orthodox have their own way of understanding marriage. It's not a contract. It's love brought into the environment of the church where it can be a union between two persons that is self-sacrificial, a kind of martyrdom of selfishness, and the service of marriages is like that. So the question is, Is this really love if we find another person useful to our self-glorification? You know, if they're especially beautiful and they make us feel important, or they're especially smart and that makes us feel smart because they respond to us. You know, we end up in relationships that where we are using other persons as accoutrements to our own effort to build a sense of who we are, a self-image. That's not love. Real love is when we, Elder Simeon uses a term that can be easily misunderstood. If we do that, we are not standing on our own two feet, which is, it sounds unfortunately to our individualistic American ears as though it refers to depending on ourselves. What do you call it?
Self-reliance.
Self-reliance. He's not talking about self-reliance. He's talking about not building up a sense of self-reliance based on moving toward other people and glomming onto them or dominating them or refusing to be dominated by them and then feeling self-reliant. Because self-reliance can come from any one of those three moves. You know, a selfish self-reliance, a self-love, a narcissism even. You know, it's a great problem in romantic love. It's difficult to work out. Not impossible, but difficult. So what I've done here is I've tried to make a link between our understanding of the fact that building ourselves up by way of physical things as attachments in this text, we're being discouraged from doing the same thing with other people because we don't have a real relationship with them. Now, the most difficult thing in this book, I think, is to understand what it is like if we don't do any of those moves. What is the alternative? If we love God rather than the world, and if we don't try to use others, none of those moves are necessary. We don't need to create ourselves because God has already created us. We are each one of us is a created being. Now I don't want to go too far into individualism is a trap here, and there's a whole chapter about that, but I get too confusing if I try to talk about it now. But we are created. We don't need to create ourselves. Our sense that we need to make that kind of effort comes from the fact that we are not in communion with God. We have communion with God, but in order to strengthen that communion with God, a spiritual effort is necessary. Purification of desire to build ourselves up by way of the things of the world involves different types of purification. Selfishness of different varieties. Pride is involved. All these things need to be dealt with. Those very same things are involved in our wrong efforts to try to get a sense of a false sense of who we are and have an ideal image by using others. And so spiritual effort is necessary in order to keep from making these moves to use others to build ourselves up. And the more we cut ourselves off from those things, the more we will not move outside of ourselves, and the result will be that we will be open to communion with God. If we stay in that place, we will be able to love others as themselves, the people that they really are, not because we're using them in some way through one of those three possible ways of strategically using others to build ourselves up. It's only that kind of love between two persons who love God, and to refer back to a previous text that we used, two people who pursue purity of heart as friendship together. So that both people are pursuing purity of heart, trying to cut themselves off from lust for the things of the world or use of others as though they were not real human beings, but both involved a spiritual effort together to purify our hearts in a Christian friendship that is love. So that's kind of background that fits into, I think, everything that's said in this book. Now, that's not obvious. But it's assumed by this book. Okay. So now I want to ask the two of you who have been here all this time, does that fit with this book? Can you see ways that it fits? And could you maybe bring something up that would help Jordan have some sense of What this book has to do with the introduction that I just spent, 20 minutes providing?
I mean, yeah, it does. It just, I just find myself, I find myself relating to people as if they're more things than they are people sometimes, you know. I do find myself, sometimes it can just be because if I'm in a certain mood, I can just kind of be free-flowing with my words and stuff like that, and kind of crack a few jokes and get people laughing and stuff like that. And that's not all bad. That's not all bad, but it's just, but it's all about, for me, it's like, if it doesn't work, if I fall flat on my face in it, here I am feeling like, I feel like my one, almost like my life's not worth living because I wasn't able to,
What do they think of me now?
Yeah, what do they think of me now? I fell flat on my face when I said that one. But when it really works good.
Oh, that was a good one.
I did good on that one. And I made some people laugh today when I said, did that, you know? And it's like,
this is the way we function on a daily basis. Yeah. And I think Elder Simeon, by using the kind of language that he does, makes it make more sense to us than if we were talking about some of the spiritual texts that are maybe more intellectually satisfying because they're filled with ideas. And we have more ideas that we can enjoy seeing how they go together and feel smart, you know. I mean, we've done a lot of books like that. This is the only book like this that we've done. But he's very gentle, you know, and I mentioned last week his style, you know. Could it be that the way we think is not quite right? And could it be that it's this way and that way? And, you know, if we're not open to it, and if we're maybe, let's say it's a little threatening, because it could be.
Yeah.
If we really relate to it, if he really gets to us, then we start thinking about how, this is... I can see that this is how I am. I know with me, you know, I can see that, I'm always filling in the great places in my little room, you know. It doesn't have to be a physical room. It can be. I mean, every place I live, I just make it into that kind of place, you know, a little comforting place, you know. It doesn't have to be grand. It doesn't have to be expensive. I could do it anywhere, you know. I've done it out in the woods. But there's also a way that I see that I do it with everything that I read, a sense of the history of human beings and philosophy. You can do it with that sort of thing too. And you think, oh boy, oh, here's another piece. It's like making a jig and making a 5,000 piece puzzle, a real 5,000 piece puzzle I'd have a lot of trouble with. But this kind of puzzle, I'll find, look at that book, oh, I know just where that fits, you know, and I read it and bonk, it fits right in there. And I can tell people, look at this picture, let me describe it to you. It sounds brilliant. Well, it's that same sort of thing that we do when we make ourselves a little cozy place. Now you have an ideal image of yourself and you share it with others. And you're protected too. That's the great thing about it. You can share this with others, and do they really know you? Do you really risk anything? No. You know, just it's the same thing you were saying. Same sort of thing. So that's the kind of thing that we're involved with in this book. What do you think, Benjamin?
It sounds a lot like Enlarged Proposal of Detachment. It's like, detachment's a virtue, try this. Here's some detail.
Yeah. Detachment is a very powerful... Your father, I think, in one of our discussions was talking about how he is familiar with the idea of detachment from things. And I think the question in his mind at the time was, are you telling me that we ought to be detached from other people? No. We should be detached from using other people as objects, as less than people. We should be detached from abusing other people to glom onto them and have a sense of identity because of their fame or power or wealth or whatever, or detached from the need to dominate and feel a sense of power over others, and detached from fear of others and building up this inner sense of security, your nice little fuzzy inside place we need to be detached from those kinds of attachments. They're really the same kind of, really doing the same kind of thing when we're doing that as when we do it with physical objects. So we should be detached from the effort to build an ideal image of ourselves using others. I mean, you see, it sounds even more demonic than using physical things, because you're not treating other human beings as real persons. So that's, I think, that's what we're involved with here.
Ultimately, detachment from the sins in very broad ways, but it's...
Well, sins, sins are something that we do, mm-hmm. You know, that's missing the mark, you know, amartya, we say. If you've read about orthodoxy in books or much or...
Not much, but
okay.
Some.
If you're familiar with the fact that Orthodox look back to the first century, then the apostles used the translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek, the Septuagint, and in the Greek Old Testament, the word for sin means to miss the mark. It is not a legal idea.
Yeah, it's not legal as the West.
Yeah, it's an idea of missing the mark. So it's something that we do. It's not breaking a rule. It's something that we do that misses the mark of how we ought to be. And we can miss the mark of how we ought to be with another human being by making them of use to us one way or another. Any one of those three ways of using another person. Which brings us up to page 49, submission which doesn't liberate. Now this is a monastic who's writing this book. So when he thinks of submission, he thinks of the submission of a young monk to an elder, and the submission trying to conquer your willfulness and your ego and all that sort of thing by being obedient to an elder is a natural way to think for a monastic. And that is a liberating kind of submission, liberating you from your self-will in that kind of monastic environment. Not that we should all submit ourselves to some kind of authority, we would reject that. But in this monastic environment of spiritual guidance, the young monk is obedient to the elder. But there is a kind of submission, Elder Simeon is saying, that does not liberate. He calls it a morbid movement toward other people. This is on page 49, about a quarter of the way in. The first characteristic of those attacked by this illness is that they are compliant toward what others say, seek, and require. Oh, I'll cooperate, I want to do this, I want to be accepted, that sort of thing. So it's a morbid, because it's not a life-producing submission, it's not a liberating submission, it's an illness. These people even lower their dignity in order to be able to ensure the love and esteem of others. And so this has got to be an example of moving toward people. See, we're still within the moving toward people section. The rest of this chapter up till page 64 is about moving toward people. Now, I'm not going to go over this in detail, but I'm just going to point out how these things that are said in this part of the chapter fit in with the things that we've outlined just previously. Bottom of the page, to secure the love, esteem, and approval of others, and especially of some person to whom he has attached himself, this is how a person will be tempted to function. And Elder Simeon says, this certainly can't be Christianity. It can't be love to submit oneself in that way. This is attaching ourselves, glomming ourselves onto another person. The next page, page 50, there is an unhealthy submission which doesn't liberate a person from their passions, from their desires, actually involves us in passions in an unhealthy way. It doesn't help us to become free from passions, selfishness, from our own will, from the old man, the old Adam. This submission is an illness which renders people unable to see clearly what they themselves are and what others are. And we get into the habit of functioning in this way with people. But if we really want to be able to love them deeply and be united at one with that person as a Christian friend who is sharing the pursuit of purity of heart, this is not going to satisfy us. Living that life of Christian friendship in a shared pursuit of purity of heart, that's what we want, that kind of intimacy with another person, not this false substitution. There is no harm in seeing others as higher and oneself as lower, or on the contrary, it's a good thing when it's healthy. When it's an unhealthy thing, however, it does a great deal of harm. Such an unhealthy submission is unhealthy because a person doesn't dare to see with his eyes open very clearly what that human being is to whom he's submitting himself, to whom he has attached himself and bound himself. Page 51, down almost halfway. A person who is living like this or has this relationship with another person submits himself slavishly to a person on whom he or she depends in a servile way. There comes about a humiliation to this person, and in the end, he's destroyed. Next heading, second line down. People who have this illness of a slavish dependence on others can't live without dependence on others. Their self-esteem depends on the approval or disapproval others show them, on the opinion that others have about them. Next page, up at the top. They are dominated by an inner chaos because this, that, or the other person on whom they are dependent, perhaps in an unconscious manner, perhaps without realizing it, didn't speak nicely to them, didn't show them the approval they were anticipating, didn't say, well done. I'm going to be bold here and jump all the way over to page 57, because this is not difficult material. And here I have a triple underline. That's the only one I've seen so far. Love as an unwholesome expression. We've been speaking about people who appear to be good Christians, but who are attacked in some way by a certain psychic illness. Remember, psyche means soul, illness of the soul. By a certain spiritual illness, and more particularly by that illness which causes them to seek the approval and esteem of others in a sick kind of way, okay, and to have their peace of mind dependent on others. Now, if our peace of mind is dependent on others, where's God? Peace of mind is dependent on others, on what position others take before them. Now, okay, what position others take before them? This is a loaded expression here. It means several things. What position others take before them? You remember, Jordan won't because he's just jumping into the middle of this book, but we will remember that the critical question is maintaining the appropriate position before God. If we depart from the stability of our relationship to God as it actually is in reality. God is the creator. We are his created beings. We are who we are before him. Human beings cannot live without communion with God. We cannot be the persons that we are without communion with God. It's a personal relationship. It doesn't exclude others, which is an interesting thing. If we have this kind of relationship with God, it will strengthen our ability to have that kind of relationship to other persons. Instead of moving toward them, trying to dominate them, trying to define ourselves by out of fear of being dominated by them, none of that's necessary. We can have a position in relationship to God and others that is good and healthy. Okay, but this person is dependent on others. What position do others take before me? That's a problem. What does that mean? It's where we put ourselves in place of God in relationship to others. We want to be treated by others as though we were God. And at the same time, we treat others as though they were almost God for us. It's an unhealthy relationship. That's what we're talking about here. Okay, now I'm happy with, except for the last page in the chapter is the only thing I'm going to, second to last page, bottom of page 63. The whole trouble today and in society, and especially among Christians, is this. We believe that evil is more powerful than good. If evil is more powerful than good, then we have got to do something. We've got to get together and oppose evil. So let's glom together. Let's find somebody that we can be dependent on, who is powerful, so that we can go out and fight evil. Because evil's powerful and we need to fight it. Is that true?
Yeah,
it's already been destroyed. The power of evil has already been destroyed. We're Christians. The power of death has been trampled down. We are free. We are free before God, free to have a relationship with God the Father through the Son, who has destroyed the power of death and given us the salvation from the presence of death in the world. A life, this is Orthodox way of understanding things, that begins with our entrance into the life in Christ by baptism, maintained by confession, fed at the chalice by communion with God. We start an eternal life now, a life that death cannot end. We begin that life, we struggle spiritually to remain faithful to that life throughout the rest of our time in this world, before the separation of soul and body. And what happens then? That life continues. It cannot be destroyed by the separation of body and soul. No power of this world can cut us off from God. That's why the martyrs were not afraid of the emperors, because they would tell them, you have no power to take my life. There's nothing you can do to me. Go ahead, separate my body and soul. I will go on. And all of the stories of the martyrs where they keep coming back and coming back and coming back, you know, all the things that are done to them, it's telling us that. That's why it happens. But we, in our 21st century materialistic, say, oh, another miracle. Oh, he's killed him again. Oh, and he's still alive. Oh, and he's killed him again. We don't really miss the point altogether. Their lives cannot be taken from them. They have a life that cannot be taken away from them. That's the life that we are meant to live. But if we are not living that life, then we'll have this idea. Evil is more powerful than good, and we have got to oppose it, and by any means necessary, except repentance and turning to God, I guess, kind of way down on the list. Last page, 64, last full paragraph. What is needed then is for us to believe without the tiniest little doubt that God has the power to redeem us from all of that. Where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. The more evil there is, the more grace we are given, we can overcome that evil. And that applies to every aspect of our lives as we live in the world as Christians. And that kind of summarizes that chapter of rejecting the necessity to glom onto others, moving toward people out of fear. That's the first strategy. The next strategy is described in chapter 3, moving against people, trying to dominate, trying to control. And that, it's interesting, that chapter is only 1, 2, 3, 4 pages long. And then chapter 4, moving away from people, much longer. And then I've asked Sharon, I said, why do you think this chapter is only 3-4 pages? Why is that? I have my answer. My answer, you know. Now, if you read Karen Horney, who is the psychologist that Elder Simeon felt that her ideas were most helpful of all of the psychologists, the founding psychologist. She died. Karen Horney died in 1952. So she's not the latest book on Amazon, you know. But he found her ideas helpful to open up a way of thinking about our life in relationship to other human beings being a strategy to establish ourselves. But when it comes to, and in Karen Horney's book, her chapter on moving against people is just as long as the other two. But in this one, it's not. I mean, why would that be? We know we're not supposed to move against other people as Christians, right? That's obvious. We're not supposed to be trying to dominate people. It is a little more confusing if we're talking about moving toward people. What does that mean, you know? And it's I think even more confusing to talk about moving away from people, because now you're talking, look, isn't this moving away from people? Isn't it an inner spiritual life? Isn't that what spirituality is all about? Well, there are denominations that are devoted to focusing on moving within oneself and trying to do things that are actually self-reliant. The Wednesday evening get-together was originally intended for inquirers.
Oh, really?
But we've gotten into the habit of making it a time after Compline into a time to focus on some book that we're reading. So, any general questions? You've been here. You've been to the Divine Liturgy.
I've read Luth.
The C.S. Lewis?
No, sorry, Luth.
sorry.
The book in class. Oh, okay.
I was in that class.
Right,
we're not
right.
Talking about Orthodoxy now for a long time.
Okay. Is that class still ongoing?
It's going about, it's on Catholicism right uh-huh. now. And I'm quite well acquainted with the Catholics, just growing up with mm-hmm. a lot of them. But this is the first time, like this year, with Orthodox. I was wondering if you could help me out a little bit. I was researching it online and I couldn't find any really satisfactory answers about the energies that you'd mentioned. That's funny that you mentioned that.
Your divine energies.
Yeah.
Well, the quickest way I could answer that is probably confusing, but I'll go ahead and say it anyway. You're familiar with the expression in Western theology, grace.
Yeah.
It has been said that the Orthodox understand the divine energies of God as his grace. In other words, God's grace is present in the created world. Mm-hmm. Now, there are two things here. You know, you read some stuff about Gregory Palamas, probably. No? Okay.
So I'm pretty...
It's good for Lautha. I don't remember if he had anything about Gregory Palamas in the book or not. But, your question was about energies. The classic distinction in Orthodox theology is between essence, divine essence, and divine energies. Our understanding is that we cannot experience God as he is in his essence. That's beyond our capacity to experience, because we're created beings. Mm-hmm. But we can and do experience God in his divine energies. Now, and that claim is that, well, there are two things involved here. One has to do with creation and the idea that, yes, creation, 7 days, fine. Is a day a day? If you want to think that, that's fine, no problem. There's no official pronouncement for no Orthodox Church that evolution is wrong, it was 7 days, that's it, you know.
Right.
If you want to think that, that's fine. It's kind of irrelevant, frankly, from our point of view. And I mean, it's not going to get you in trouble unless you start going out beating everybody up about it, you know, and say, hey, you know, you can't teach this in school because the Bible says, you know, I mean, what are you doing? You know, it's what's the point of that? If you want to think it's 7 days, that's fine. It doesn't hurt anything. You can still understand the content of what is there in Genesis, if that's the way you interpret it. But if you make it into a substitute for science, then you've misunderstood the text, because that's not what it's about. What it's about, it doesn't matter whether you think it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days, or whether you could say, you know, that a day is as 1,000 years, or as St. Basil the Great wrote in the 4th century about Genesis and described a development, a progression that he saw within the Genesis story. So in other words, it isn't just, you know, now this exists, now this exists, now this exists. He saw a movement. He saw a progression. It fits in within that 7-day description. It fits in with the idea that Adam and Eve were not created absolutely perfect and finished in every way that they could be perfect, you know, which is the Western idea, but not ours. Our idea is that they have a calling. They abandon that calling and were not able to do as human beings are meant to do in the world. That calling was lost, and it was picked up by Jesus Christ when he came into the world. And he gave us a way of entering into his own perfect humanity, because he's fully God, fully man. We can, because we're human beings, but our humanity is meant to be as Christ's humanity is. And the part that has to do with energies is this. There's an idea that God did not just create a world that is kind of flat and separate from him, you know.
Okay, yeah.
But there is present in the world that God created an ongoing presence of his active energy. If that were withdrawn, it would go away. It's in other words, it was not created as fully separate from him. Now, Western theologians, especially once
they
started
to,
they would say that's pantheism.
Oh, okay, I was about to say.
Yeah, that's pantheism. And they say, no, that's wrong, it's pantheism. Well, for a while, the Orthodox came up with the word panentheism, and it seemed to work for a while. But then the Protestants took panentheism and started to redefine it in their own way. You can find examples of it on the internet now where it really gets confused. I'm not sure that word is helpful anymore. But when they first started using it, when the Orthodox first started using it, they made the point that God is present in the world, but God and the world are not the same thing. We don't worship the world. We don't worship God's creation. They're not identical. The world that he created is not God. It's not divine. It's created, but his divine energy is present in the world and experienceable in the world. That's one part of it that has to do with creation. The other part of it is this. The controversy arose between the Orthodox monks on Mount Athos, which is still there. You know, Benjamin and I got to visit there. Gregory Palamas was a monk on Mount Athos and also later a bishop in the city of Thessaloniki. We got to go to his church and see his sarcophagus. And this is like 14th century. Western theology was really getting off the ground in a big way at that point. Aquinas had come, you know, his ideas were there. And their idea was you cannot, and Augustine had said, you cannot meet God in the physical. Which is a really weird thing to say from an Orthodox point of view. You cannot meet God in a physical. I mean, we're all about meeting God in the physical, you know. Right. Because, I mean, what are you saying? You know, how about the incarnation? You know, we have icons because we're saying that God made matter spirit bearing, you know, as it was meant to be, and kind of is in terms of the creation of the world and divine energies present in God's creation. So the idea that you cannot meet God in a physical, what's this, how about communion? You know, you're not meeting God in communion. Well, they have their own theology for that, you know, and Aquinas developed it, it's transubstantiation. Well, it is and it isn't, based on Aristotle and all that sort of thing. You know, they came up with that in the Middle Ages in the West. So there was a big conflict between theologians who thought like Western Christians had begun to think in the Middle Ages and Gregory Palamas. There was a big argument. It was the last big argument, East and West. And Barlaam from Calabria, who knew about orthodoxy but wasn't really orthodox and didn't really understand it, the monks said that they could experience God in an uncreated light. There had been monks that had experienced the light of Mount Tabor when Peter, James, and John went up to Mount Tabor and Christ revealed his divinity to them. It was like this bright light that would just knock them down. It was the divine light. Orthodox say it is possible to experience that. But when you do, you are experiencing God in his energies. He's revealing himself in his energies. With your physical eyes, you can experience it, but not his essence. His essence is beyond our capacity to experience, is how God is in and of himself. Before creation, before created time, space, and the experience of the divine light has to do with Christ. And there are examples of seeing saints radiating the divine light as the presence of Christ, being Christ-bearing, as all human beings were created to be. And that is considered a holy experience of the presence of God by way of some human being. Well, it's rejected in the West. Or they could just say, oh, it's a miracle. You know, it's you know, because there are always kind of appearances, the Theotokos comes in. Sure, we have that too. We have that too, you know. But no, we're talking about something in particular here. You know, and not just not a vision or even a visitation, right, you know, by a saint. We're talking about the divine light, and the West says, no, not possible.
Just like I guess that would be the Catholic views with the Blessed Virgin Mary appearing
right
in random areas, Guadalupe.
Yeah.
And
which is, you know, mm-hmm. we would say that, we wouldn't say, no, that doesn't happen. Sure, we would say that happens, yes. But we're talking about the experience of the divine light, the uncreated light, is uncreated, it's important. Because the main distinction is between uncreated and created. This is not just a physical light show here by way of the physical world. It is an uncreated light. It is the presence of God, we would say. So, but in his energies, you know. So that's where the energies comes in.
That's
now, also, we use that term to refer to the grace of God. So the grace of God is a presence of God.
Okay.
It's not just zapped across the abyss, you know, you know, from up there down here, pow, you know, just like, kind of like the sacraments are from a Roman Catholic point of view.
Yeah.
Channels of grace. Channels of grace. Only in these channels, nowhere else. And to come, you got, and to have one of these channels of grace, you've got to come to the church, receive one of the sacraments, seven channels of grace, you know, pow, 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 pow. That's it. Those channels, nowhere else. That's the Western idea. Oh, we reject that.
It's too legal, very legal.
Yeah, exactly. And because you can't experience God in the physical. Well, we say, no, that's not true. How could you say that? Okay.
So for next time, we should read.
Let's do moving against people. It's only a few pages. We won't go into moving away from people. So that'll be pages 67 through 72.
Okay.
If you want me to, I can scan these pages and make them available to you if you were to want to come and talk about this sometime.
Actually, I'll just take a picture of the title and I can find it. I'm sure it's on Amazon.
You might be able to. You might be able to.
Oh, is it pretty?
It's becoming more difficult to get hold of. You know how Amazon is. If something gets difficult to hold of, all of a sudden it costs, you know, $300, you know.
Yeah, Amazon's been getting weird lately too.
The place that I've had most success getting that is the Greek Orthodox Seminary in Brookline, Massachusetts, Holy Cross, the Hellenic College Bookstore in Brookline. They have it
in
their bookstore.
They have online, that's an online bookstore.
Yes. Okay. That's where I got these. Or Monastery of St. John, Shanghai and San Francisco. Let's see who publishes it. That's the other place. Divine Ascent Press. Did you take a picture of it?
I took a picture of the title.
Okay, yeah, take a picture of that, and then you'll have that.
Well, thank you so much for
okay
adjusting.